Welcome to GeekWire. I'm GeekWire co-founder Todd Bishop, and I'm sad to report today that Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen has died at the age of 65. Paul Allen was a giant figure at Microsoft and beyond, founding a huge number of companies, research institutions, philanthropies, and arts organizations. He passed away Monday from complications from non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. It was his second fight with the disease, and his absence will be felt in almost every corner of life in Seattle and many other parts of the country and the world. In Paul's memory, we are sharing a conversation I had with him on stage in 2011 at Town Hall after the release of his autobiography, Idea Man. I remember this experience of interviewing Paul Allen like it was yesterday. I introduced him on stage at Town Hall in Seattle, and it was like a homecoming. You could hear the crowd react to him, and he was so candid in so many things, everything from his relationship with Bill Gates to his yachts and what it was like to have giant boats that went around the world. It was just really a fascinating discussion, and I have lots of strong memories of being both on stage with him and in the green room beforehand. It was just a really remarkable experience, and I think the tech world and the world at large are worse for his passing. We're glad we can share his words directly with you in this episode, and please check GeekWire for the most up-to-date coverage of his passing.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us. And Paul, I want to thank you for doing this with us tonight, for being here, and welcome home to Seattle.
Thanks. It's great to be in front of a local crowd. Thanks, everybody.
I'd like to start with a question that I know is on the minds of almost every person in this room, particularly given the events of the past few weeks. And Paul, it involves a relationship that I know is very important to you. It's a relationship that's had many ups and downs over the years, many triumphs and challenges, and currently faces an uncertain future. So I just want to get this question out of the way right off the bat. Is Matt Hasselbeck coming back to the Hawks next year? Well, you were thinking something else?
That's a very good question, but you know, obviously we're kind of in no man's land in the labor dispute right now. So when that's over, I'm sure we'll talk to Matt and his agent again. But there's nothing resolved at this point.
That's great. I didn't actually expect a serious answer to that.
I hope. I thought this was supposed to be serious.
I hope there's some sports reporters in the audience that got that. Paul, at the end of Idea Man, you describe the book as one of the hardest things that you've done in your life, which is actually a pretty remarkable statement. What did you learn about yourself through the process of writing this book?
Well, it was an interesting process. I'd always intended to do a book at some point, just going through my career in technology and the amazing spectrum of opportunities I've had and things I've been able to pursue. But when I got sick in October, November of 2009, it was time to do it because I wasn't sure I'd be able to finish it. So I would, working on the book, I would get up each day and try to get down some of my thoughts, and it helped me get the process of doing that, helped me get through each day, and was, you know, stimulated my brain. But when you do something like this, you know, there's a real revisiting of both the ups and downs of your life. And, you know, there's definitely some peak moments and some, you know, moments of, you know, that where things happened that, you know, weren't necessarily what you hoped for or were tough or you had to make tough decisions. And so some of those moments when you revisit them, you go back over them over and over again, because another thing that happened is my background in computer programming in a certain way was re-energized in terms of the editing of the book. I edited every word in the book 8 times. And I remember that I'm kind of a stickler for exactness. So when you go over those tough moments after eight times, you just don't want to do it much more. But it was very rewarding. It was very rewarding to do it.
This book received a lot of coverage in the media prior to its release. In fact, it's somewhat ironic. I think one of the advantages of telling your own story usually is that you get to tell your own story, but in some ways that didn't happen in this case. For those who are just getting the book, who may have read some of the media coverage or the excerpts, what messages do you hope they actually take away from the real book and what you've written here?
Well, I'm someone that I basically get very, very excited about the creative process and creating things and having ideas. And when you see those ideas realized, it's just a wonderfully rewarding thing. So obviously being fortunate to be involved in the birth of Microsoft, and then recently things like the Brain Institute, those are amazingly rewarding things that carry on a certain legacy that I'm very proud of. And then of course there's parts where things are more challenging and you make mistakes. And so I hope people, when they read the book, can take away some lessons from my mistakes and ups and downs over the years too. But basically I hope they get a sense of me as a person who's creative, and then maybe you can think about creative possibilities in your own life based on what's in the book.
Yeah. Has your candor about Bill Gates in the book jeopardized your longtime friendship with him?
I don't think so, but I'm sure there are things in the book that Bill wants to discuss, and he'll have a different slant about them. And Bill and I have had many intense discussions over the years, and we haven't had a chance to talk about the book since it was published. I gave him a copy months ahead of publication, so we'd have a head start on it. So that discussion will be a very, very intense, and he'll be very direct, and as will I.
Do you think you'll be able to move on from that? And
Oh yeah. Obviously, we've gone through so many things, over the years, and my departure. You know, his leaving Microsoft, retiring. I mean, he's chairman of Microsoft, is retiring. I mean, so many different things over the years. We both tried to help each out, in different ways over the years too, as I talk about in the book, when he came to visit me when I was sick.
Yeah, absolutely. You recently, went through a second bout with cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And you write in the book that your illness the second time has made you simultaneously more patient and less patient. Can you explain for the audience and for us, for the people who may not have read the book, what you meant by that?
Well, I think you're more patient because you realize that whenever you go through one of these treatment regimens, there are many things that are completely out of your control, you just have to be patient and hope things work out for the best and be optimistic and take a positive attitude. On the other hand, you realize that if there isn't a positive outcome, your time may be limited, so it makes you that much more focused on realizing your dreams and hopes, because all of our times on this planet are limited. So it basically you're hit over the head with that idea when these things happen, and it gives you an impetus to accelerate the things you really care about.
So how has it changed how you plan to approach the remainder of your life? Will we see new things in your life as a result of that experience?
No, I'm casting a wider net, and I'm trying to move forward some of these things like the Brain Institute, and trying to make them more ambitious and more successful in their scope, not just the Brain Institute, but other things that we're working on, and to try to realize those things more quickly. And certainly in technology, it's almost true that you can't move too quickly. But things like research on the brain, that takes decades. So you're trying to plan the course of an organization that's hopefully going to have an impact 10, 20, 30, 50 years in the future. So it's all those things. And of course, on another very important note, I mean, you realize, I realized when I was 30, and of course I realized again, this time when I found out that I was unfortunately sick again, that the support you get from your family and friends is so key to getting through any of these kinds of illnesses.
You're also very candid in the book about your feelings about your analysis of present day Microsoft. It's a great chapter in the book called Hellhounds, referring to the lineup of Facebook and Google and Apple and all the others that are eating Microsoft's lunch in some ways. If you were still around as chief technology officer, for example, what would you do? What would be your prescription for Microsoft today?
Well, when these new platforms, the PC was a new platform. So when these new platforms come into existence, or come into existence in a very strong new way, whether it's the iPhone coming on the scene or the iPad coming on the scene, you have to recognize those and jump on the opportunity and be competitive as fast as you can. And I think I think Microsoft is trying its best to address those now, but they're trying to creep up on the and match the competition there that's already got a very strong presence in iPhone and Google's Android. So these new platforms are key, and you just can't you have to have the agility. You can't miss the opportunity and let others own that opportunity. And so I think Microsoft is pulling out all the stops now, as far as I understand from talking to people there, to try to recapture those opportunities.
Yeah. So a bit of a litmus test here. Do you carry an iPhone, Windows Phone, Android, or BlackBerry?
Actually, I am a little bit old school. I use a BlackBerry because my mother, God bless her, forced me to take touch typing when I was 16. So I got really fast thumbs on the BlackBerry keyboard. Not so much on an iPhone, and I send quite a few emails every day. So, but I'm sure at some point I'll convert to a new platform.
Hey, what might that new platform be?
I'm still evaluating. I'm looking at all the alternatives, and I think it's important, if you love technology, to try the different alternatives, to try the iPhone and the new Windows mobile phone is a great platform. So, and Android. So I've tried them all, and they're all different. They're all interesting. But my whole thing is to try to imagine where technology is going to go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years from now, and see where how the chips that are in the products are developing, and see how that's going to influence things, and then see how the software that's coming along is going to influence the platforms. So I think it's fascinating. And this is kind of my, I consider my forte is trying to understand where things are going. And I don't think you can do that without trying all the different alternatives.
You're listening to GeekWire. We are playing a conversation that I had back in 2011 with Paul Allen, the co-founder of Microsoft, in remembrance of his life as we report the news today, Monday, October 15th, 2018, of his passing at the age of 65. We'll be right back.
Mac, Windows, or Linux?
Windows, come on.
Really?
Sorry.
Star Wars, Star Trek, or Battlestar Galactica?
All.
No. Okay. All right. Okay, in another setting I would press on that, but I think you got some fans in the audience there. Okay. On the subject of science fiction, one of the things that you mentioned in the book is the inspiration that this book played in your life, Rocket Ship Galileo.
Right.
In fact, I was inspired to go find it on eBay as a result of your mention. It's about teenage boys who build a rocket in the desert and blast right. off to the moon. And, the parallels to your own life are hard to miss. What did science fiction mean to you as a kid? How did it shape your life? And how is it still part of your life today?
Well, I still read a fair amount of science fiction just for fun. I think back in those days, the concepts of whether it's communication satellites or going to the moon. I mean, in the late 50s and 60s, we used to go. I went to Ravenna School in North Seattle. And used to wheel in a TV on a cart, and we'd watch the Mercury and Gemini and Apollo, launches in grade school. I guess by Apollo, what you're talking about, actually, about junior high and high school. But so there was that love of, space and space travel was in the air. And I'll never forget, You know, my mother loved, both my parents loved books. My father worked at the University of Washington library as a top manager there, and so I grew up around books. And my mother, working in this thrift store, she would always say, you know, and the problem was she would price books at the thrift store. So every day she'd say, huh, and then she'd come home with a sack of books. And she'd say, well, how can you not buy a good book for 15 cents? And so she was supposed to be selling these books. I grew up around so many books, but one time she took me to the library in Wedgwood, and I found in the juvenile science fiction section, I found Rocket Ship Galileo, and that was my entree to science fiction, and I just loved it. And I think it inspires your creativity and your ability to think out of the box and think that wild and crazy ideas are possible. And it just amazes me that I've been able to live and see realized some of those wild and crazy ideas, like Spaceship One.
Yeah. Speaking of Spaceship One, you obviously accomplished much there in collaboration with your team. It's an understatement. Why not continue with that and get into commercialization of space full bore? And why leave that to guys like Richard Branson? I mean, does he really deserve to ride on your coattails with that?
Well, Richard is super enthusiastic about private commercial space tourism, and more power to him. And they've licensed the technology used in Spaceship One for Spaceship Two. If you talk about getting to orbit, you have to have a much bigger rocket. It basically takes over seven times as much energy to get a pound of anything or a person into space. So that means a much bigger rocket, a much more capable system. So I'm very intrigued by the possibilities of doing something like that, but no announcement yet. I did find that the experience as a programmer of seeing a test pilot go straight up at Mach 5 and this rocket that's been built in a couple of years and with some brand new software in it. I mean, in Microsoft, if you get and you're developing something, you get an error message, you can say, okay, fine, let's start it again, just debug it. That's what I used to do. Something goes wrong in a rocket, it's usually there's an extremely bad outcome. So before the flights, I would have a speech in my pocket, basically saying, "I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, we've had a departure from normal flight, and there's been a fatality or whatever." So you had to be ready for that, and that was very far from my experience. So if I do enter in something like that, I'll have to be cognizant of those risks. Those test pilots are extremely brave individuals and skilled.
You mentioned earlier the Allen Institute for Brain Science, and the potential impact of the Allen Institute may be hard for non-scientists to understand. Can you paint a picture for us of what the world will be like someday, how it will be different if the research that you're funding accomplishes what you hope?
Well, any brain research is a long-term, first I'll say any brain research is a long-term project because it's so amazingly complex and so mysterious, and we're just starting to understand the outlines of how things work, I guess is how I would characterize it. So there's two different aspects to the question. One is understanding how the human brain, or any brain, the mouse brain is actually the brain that we did first, the set of brains we did first. How do they work? How do they function? How do they react to their environment and learn and react in novel ways? Process information. It's so completely different the way a computer does, and it's in some of the program computers that fascinates me. I mean, the brain was designed by evolution, so each part of it is optimized for what it does. And so it's incredibly, incredibly complex. And I like to think recently about the idea of there's a complexity break that slows you down, because the minute you get in these things, you think, okay, I'm starting to understand this. Then you realize, oh, no, it's 10 or 100 times more complex. To fully understand that thing that aspect of the brain than you thought. So anyway, there's the whole set of things, excuse me, that has to do with understanding how the brain works. That's completely fascinating just because we all want to understand really how do our minds work? Why are we who we are? All those amazing questions, and ultimately, we'll arrive at some, decades from now, we'll arrive at a much better understanding of that. Then there's, trying to understand basically at a chemical level, at a biologic level, how the different parts of the brain work. And if you understood that and those aspects, of the medical aspects of the brain, then you could possibly bring forward, treatments to neurodegenerative diseases, like Alzheimer's, which my mother suffers from. So you're very hopeful when you do these things, like we released our data on the mouse brain, which is an important experimental animal, and now our first set of human brains, that will bring forward and make happen earlier, some possible treatments for those diseases.
How optimistic are you?
No, I'm very optimistic, and the approach we've taken is fairly unique, not completely unique, but it's like the Human Genome Project, where you're trying to put a database of information online that scientists around the world can access for free, and that will accelerate all of their research. So they don't have to say, okay, genetics of the human brain, I need to start slicing up some tissue and looking at that. But that data is already online, so they can say, okay, a gene that's related to Prozac, what parts of the brain are affected by Prozac? And then if you combine Prozac with something else, you have them, it can tell you many, many things. And it can potentially accelerate all of their research so that to get to the core of the problem, so we really understand something, all these different scientists can benefit. And amazingly, and rewardingly, it's become a standard tool for scientists to use that care about the genetics of the brain already.
Speaking of the brain, let's talk about music for a second. This is a topic that I wanted to explore, and based on some of the audience questions, you do too. So I'm going to mix a few of your questions in with mine.
My band is here tonight too, but they're not playing. So just be clear about that.
I saw them downstairs. They look like quite the group.
They are, but I won't get into that.
In the book, you write about the catharsis of playing music, and you talk about how you're on a good riff and your shoulders just sink in. What does music mean to you?
Well, I mean, music is another mysterious thing, but it's a form of expression. So you can play a chestnut of a blues tune, and yet when you play a solo on that, you can go to a creative place where you're just riffing in your own particular way with your own expression, and it's just a wonderful thing. And being able to, in the book I talk about meeting some of the amazing musicians I've been able to play with over time, those experiences have, because I just consider myself a decent amateur guitar player. Some of these people are, there's a reason, a Mick Jagger or Bono or any of these people, they are extremely talented at what they do. I mean, amazing. And they can improvise. And, I mean, it's an extremely creative process they go through and create their amazing works of art. So I just feel wonderful. It just feels wonderful to me to be able to jam with my band and play some songs and then occasionally have these unbelievable experiences, whether it's just witnessing others create or actually very occasionally, be able to play with them.
You tell this great story in the book about Bono convincing Mick Jagger to play Satisfaction, to sing Satisfaction as you play. Can you explain how Bono pulled that one off?
Well, he's a clever one, that Bono. A friend of mine was throwing a birthday party for Mick, and I had brought a bunch of equipment that we could have kind of an improvised jam. And I asked Mick a couple times, Mick, you feel like playing? And He just didn't seem into it.
It's like, nah, like that. Is that what he did?
You know, it's his birthday party, whatever. So then I go to Mono. I said, "Hi, Mono, I don't know what to do. Mick doesn't feel like playing, but it kind of might be fun." He says, "I know what we'll do. I'll sing his song really slowly, and he'll have to sing it. I know he'll have to sing it." So we start playing Satisfaction. And Bono's singing it really slowly. And Mick starts to look nervous. Like, something has gone wrong in the universe. That's my song. This has to stop. So he went and grabbed the microphone and he's singing Satisfaction. I'm playing the main riff to Satisfaction extremely nervously behind him. And then when the song was over, I look over at Bono and Bono goes, "Told you." Anyway, so. That was a fantastic little interlude there.
What's your favorite guitar?
Oh, I play what was Hendrix's favorite guitar. Is a Fender Stratocaster. It's electric guitar, and it's not that easy to play. But if you can get your technique halfway decent, then you can make some amazing sounds and feedback and everything else come out of it. I was fortunate to see Jimmy play here in Seattle twice. I think he came three times, once at Six Stadium, I think once at Key Arena. And those, my first concert actually was at Key Arena, and that was a mind-blowing experience for I guess I was 17, something like that. So that was, I was another Seattleite. I was kind of at the feet of trying to learn, some of Jimmy's things. And for years, I would play along to records without any help, trying to just, how the heck does he do that? And, so year after year, I would, I'd slave away. Because probably as a teenager, at some point I thought, well, I could go into programming or music. Programming or music. Programming won, but I never stopped playing, and so I kept slowly shedding my way through Purple Haze year after year. And so, like, after 25 years, I could play a half-decent Purple Haze. And it was funny to talk to his bass player, Noah Redding, and I'd say, what was it like, when Jimmy would come in? He'd say, he'd come in like after, one night, and the next day he'd come in, he'd say, "Here's a song called The Wind Cries Mary, and, I wrote it in about half an hour, and here we go. Let's record it." I'm going like, "It took me 25 years. 25 years." So
it's remarkable that a lot of engineers, actually, software engineers, are musicians, as well. It's an interesting correlation. And there's other similarities too. You're sort of in a band of other programmers. And so in some ways you were part of one of the greatest bands ever. It was called Microsoft,
We had our hits. We did. So, a few in the top 10 there, I think.
Yeah.
We'll be right back with more of my 2011 conversation with Paul Allen at Town Hall in Seattle.
You explain in the book, shifting back a little bit to business here, you explain in the book that one of your abilities, one of your knacks, is to see what's next, to piece together different things that are coming up, dating back to your early days, reading, the early hobbyist magazines, and piece them together into one big idea and recognize that that's the thing you need to pursue. Why haven't more of your ideas since Microsoft seen more commercial success?
Well, sometimes you can be too early. That's one possible. There's many ways. Having the idea is not sufficient. You have to have a great team of people. You have to be able to execute and realize the idea. You have to be able to convince people to try out the idea and market and sell it. If you're involved in big companies, there's financial aspects you have to be very, very cognizant of to make sure everything's in good shape financially. So I talk in the book very directly about all the different ways things can go wrong, of which there are a few. So that's just But that's part of the, you know, if you're creative and you try things and you're a risk taker, some number of those things are going to fail. Now, if you read the book, you'll know some ways to avoid those things, the failures. So I hope. I'm just joking.
No, but
kind of.
You did help to create one of the most successful startups in the history of the world. What have you learned through that experience and through your more recent experiences about the most important ingredients for creating successful businesses?
Well, again, I mean, the first thing you start with is the idea. And to get to the idea, my approach has always been just, it may seem a little random, but it's just to stuff your brain with as many ideas, you know, as much information about, in this case, computer chips and software, kind of as your brain can stand. And then I'm just lucky enough to every once in a while I'll see a connection between two things, like microprocessor chips and software, and in this case the basic language, which is what Microsoft's first product was. So you have to have the idea, then you have to find the team, and I was lucky, you know, to meet Bill in high school, and we met another guy at Harvard that could write the math part of BASIC, and so we had a team there that turned out that first BASIC in under 2 months, and then I flew out to Albuquerque with it. So that you have to have the right team, and then you have to, you know, there is definitely some luck of you know, microprocessors, the marketplace, the Altair computer was there, and we had a customer, and the next thing you knew, we were off and running, and then everybody wanted our BASIC. So all of those factors come into play.
Since leaving Microsoft, your primary focus in business and technology has been as an investor. Did you ever consider, or would you even consider today, picking one of your ideas and making a comeback as a day-to-day chief technology officer?
No, I really leave the development of programs and those things to people that are familiar with how to implement things these days. My knowledge of implementation, although I could get back in there and ask some really tough questions, but it's, which I do.
Yeah.
That's one of the things I do is ask, I try to ask the best possible questions I can, but chief CTO, no, but I do, look at user interfaces. I've always felt that was a really interesting, way to add value. So I do look at those things and people in different organizations that I've spent time with will tell you that, just the craft of technology, if you follow it through the years, is a place you can add value.
Now, you and Bill, this is an audience question. You and Bill started at a time when the microprocessor was being revolutionized into the next generation. What do you see as the next evolution or revolution? And it doesn't specify a subject area, but is there something along those lines coming up that you see as equivalent to the revolution of the microprocessor?
Well, equivalent to the microprocessor, no, that was a radical change, basically in the performance you got for a very low price. Suddenly, all of a sudden, people could buy a computer that could do something for $1,000, and they did. So that was amazing. I think when I look to the future now, I think of both these new platforms that I already mentioned, the smartphone platform and the tablet platform. But I think of where software can be 10, 15, 20 years from now and how we can build more artificial intelligence and things like that. I think recently people have seen with Watson that won the Beat Human Players on Jeopardy. That's an example, but not the only one of the way forward. We have another project at we're doing at Vulcan called Halo, which is trying to encode the knowledge in a biology textbook into software, so you can ask questions. It's very, very challenging to do some of those things. So you can't things that ambitious. You look at a very long time frame to actualize them. But there's so many exciting areas. I mean, just look in the last 5, 6, 7 years. Social networks came from nowhere.
Yeah, you're on Twitter. What do you think of Twitter and Facebook and all that?
Well, I was thinking, the other day I was thinking, I should send out some tweet like, as kind of a joke saying, bitter billionaire retires, this is my last tweet. Look out, Howard Hughes. Going to Vegas today. No, but...
Nice.
But...
Yes.
I just don't like High Station Zebra that much. I can't see my... That was his favorite movie. He just sat there watching it over and over. Anyway, I just can't see it. No, but I think anything where you can follow, you know, people that are sending... I think the most interesting thing about Twitter, for example, is people will send you links to things they find interesting, articles. And so now there's starting to appear some things that will show you all the articles directly of things that, you know, that kind of tastemakers and people that follow technology. I mean, if you look on my Twitter account, you're going to see, you know, people everywhere from comedy to technology to science. It's a pretty broad range of different things. So I think that's a great way of helping you aggregate stimulating knowledge and trends and things like that. And then you have things like, then you have Facebook and the other sites like that that are more about staying in touch with your friends. And you know, we're such social animals that it's amazing if you think about it, why wasn't something like Facebook done years earlier? It could have been. And there was nothing stopping that from occurring. It's just you have to have the idea. So there's always things that come down the pike that you don't expect that suddenly affect all of our lives in a great way. And I think that's one of the wonderful aspects of technology.
That was Paul Allen in 2011 speaking with me at Town Hall after the release of his book, Idea Man. To find much more coverage of his life and impact on the tech world, go to geekwire.com. Thanks for listening, everybody, and rest in peace, Paul. Until next time, I'm Todd Bishop. You're listening to GeekWire.